What's up, everybody? It's Tuesday. The Super Bowl is over. This is the, oh no, it's the Brady Grant Football Show! I mean, I gotta tell you that those lasers were post Super Bowl lasers.
I don't have much energy left, man. Yeah. You and I both talked about our traveling back through the old ATL airport. That was quite a doozy. It was an early morning, long day. And look, the Super Bowl, it was what it was. I actually didn't mind the game, the way it went. I thought the Patriots would win. I thought they'd cover. I didn't think it would be that low scoring, though. That was the biggest shocker about that whole thing to me. But I do think I've got some reasons why it happened, Will.
Oh, great. I would love to hear him. And I am, of course, Will Brinson. That is, of course, Brady Quinn. This is the Pick Six Podcast. If you're just joining in, as we head into the off season, we'll be doing these every single day. When I say it out loud, like a little part of my soul dies. Not that I love the podcast. I love doing the podcast, but the realization that something has to happen every day, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, from now until football season starts is not, I don't know if it's a little daunting. It's just a little like, huh. Is that fair? Is that unfair of me? Should I be?
Do you do 7 days a week? Or five, do you do 5 days?
5 days a week.
Oh, okay. So, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least you get weekends off, you know? I mean, it's not like you're grinding that hard. It's just a podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is not that hard. And it leaves me free time to go play horseshoes, in random downtown bars until 2 a.m. Hypothetically speaking, if that's something that people would do, during Super Bowl week.
What's that? Hypothetically what?
Playing horseshoes at 2 a.m. in downtown bar.
Hypothetically, yes. Yes. And then almost being killed by a horseshoe. That is something that also may happen during Super Bowl week, down in a dungeon of sorts of places.
Yeah.
Even though it did have a nice bar. So,
it did, yeah. You know. I mean, hypothetically, who amongst us hasn't had their wife almost kill them with a horseshoe at 2 a.m. in a downtown bar? Moving along, let's let's talk about the actual game, because John Breach and Ryan Wilson and I recorded a podcast literally after the game from my hotel room at 3 a.m. I mean, I'm sure you can hear it in our voices. I was like fighting sleep off as we were sitting there recording. And I do want to take a more of a deep dive with you, Brady, because the schematics of all this, and I've done some radio hits today, some radio hits yesterday on Monday. So we went back and watched some of the game and want to finish doing that later. What do you think? Okay. How was Sean McVay, who admitted after the game that he was outcoached, how was he not prepared for what Bill Belichick brought defensively, which was essentially playing zone when the Patriots were mostly a man team, right?
Yeah. I don't know if it's that simplified, because there were some variations of things that they did more in regards to their pass rush. I thought that was really what we thought was the biggest thing going into this, was whether or not the Rams offensive line could handle the variation of looks that this Patriots defensive front gives you throughout the course of a game. You know, the three down looks, the four down looks, the five down looks, or, you know, even within those three and four down looks, the way they move around Van Noy, the way they move around Hightower, and the way they stunt and run games after the snap of the football. So they change that picture for the offensive line. It's a lot to deal with. And it's especially a lot to deal with on a field that felt a lot like a New England Patriots home game. So your communication becomes that much more impacted by it. And let's be honest, it's not so much Sean McVay. Like, this offense didn't execute very well. The offensive line got beat one-on-one. There's no doubt about it. Jared Goff seemed shook at times. It was just not a good game all the way around. Brandon Cooks had a number of opportunities to make plays in the football. He made some, didn't make the ones that he really needed to. So at the end of the day, it was a true team loss by the LA Rams, but you got to give credit to the New England Patriots and the game plan, because you're right. Even though they play a ton of man-to-man, the formations and the condensed splits, those usually force teams to play a lot of man-to-play zone anyway. So they've probably seen a decent amount of that this year, regardless of how much, you know, man a team plays coming into it, because of their style of offense. I think the thing that stood out to me why the secondary was able to be so successful versus the Rams was this. When you run a bunch of 11 personnel, and that's primarily what they ran, and that's three wide receivers, one tight end, one running back, it allows a defense with whatever unit it is, whether it's nickel, whether it's dime, they now can settle in and say, this is what this wide receiver runs from this position, from this split, from this bunch or stack formation. They don't have to worry about teaching those concepts and those schemes to their base defensive personnel, right? Or their big defensive personnel, because all you do is one personnel grouping. So you can do what's called pattern match. And the New England Patriots were as good as anyone, in particular when they faced the St. Louis Rams, the greatest show on turf. One of the reasons why I think they were so successful in that game was because you weren't taking Torrey Holt and Isaac Bruce and Marshall Faulk off the field, right? So even though you had these variations of things you would do, you also had tendencies. And with 2 weeks to prepare, you better believe the New England Patriots were prepared for every single thing that offense was going to do based on where a guy lined up and what their tendencies were. And that's, to me, what became fairly obvious, because it wasn't like there was a ton of free rushers, with the exception of the pressure on the interception by Goff, which was just an awful play on his part. It was typically coverage sacks. Like, the coverage and the front worked hand in hand and getting pressure on Goff when there really just wasn't anything downfield.
Okay, I have a couple of questions here. I'm going to try to remember them. I should have written them down. You mentioned pattern matching. When you say pattern matching, the first name that comes to mind for me, and maybe anybody, is Nick Saban. Everybody knows, I think, right? Nick Saban worked for Bill Belichick once upon a time. They're very good friends. Were the Patriots doing, and look, there's a lot of, look, football jabronis, myself included, out there talking about man versus zone, and we're not seeing what Jared Goff is seeing. It's a different story when you're actually playing quarterback in your third year. The stats add up. You know, he has 11 interceptions against zone, this season versus just one interception against man. That's a pretty significant difference. Were they kind of running a Nick Saban type of cover three pattern match? What was going on back there that Jared Goff was seeing? And is it a situation where in the infancy of his career, you know, he's not really capable of reading an entire field, with the speed required relative to what the Patriots were doing? Was that the main issue?
Well, the main issue, I'd say, is I do feel like the speed of the game seemed too fast for him.
Yeah.
Like, he was always just a little bit late. Like, their longest game was a completion of Robert Woods in the sidelines that was honestly incomplete.
Yeah.
And fortunate for the Rams, they rushed up, got a play off, so it ended up being complete in the books. But when you go back and look at it on tape, it should have been incomplete. So the officials missed that call to the benefit of the Rams. But pattern matching is this. Pattern matching is like saying, well, if Brandon Cooks takes a split, where all of a sudden he's 6 yards outside the ghost tight end, he can only run one of a few things, or he's limited in kind of what he's going to do, right? He's not just going to run straight down the field. We can eliminate that. He's most likely, if he's going to run some sort of deeper route or intermediate route, it's going to be outbreaking because he's at a condensed split. If he wants to run an in route, he has to widen his release on the snap of the football and then get vertical to then come inside. And he's usually not going to be the first read in that case. And then the thing he can do, he can run a shallow crossing route. So you're kind of limited in what you can do based on a condensed split. What it allows you to do, though, is not be in press man-to-man coverage. Because of how close you are to all the other traffic, a lot of defensive backs, or cornerbacks in particular, will have to play off so they can run through some of the traffic in order to still cover that player. So there's give and take to what you do. So when I say pattern match, I mean they're looking at a lot of their single-man, two-man, and three-man route combinations, and they're saying based on how they're lining up in this bunch, in this stack, or in these condensed splits, depending on the formation, this is what these guys are going to run. And so that's more what pattern matching is. They played different variations of zone, the majority of which I saw were more post-high, mostly because they wanted the extra defender down around the box,
right,
to try to stop the run. So there was a fair amount of that. But when I say pattern matching, that's more what I'm meaning, just having a tendency and being able to jump some of the routes or react to some of the routes they're running faster because of the preparation leading up to the game.
Right. And again, like we talked about it all week long, no one in their right mind, everyone loves Sean McVay. He's a great young offensive mind, you know, great smart offensive coach. He got a lot of people hired. No one is going to try and tell you that he has a schematic advantage with 2 weeks of preparation over Bill Belichick, and that became pretty clear. It did matter. On the McVay thing, though, Why did McVay realize this? I thought that they might change up their personnel, maybe go with two tight ends more often, maybe try and run
out
of those.
They actually did. When you looked at it in the second half, when they started to move the football and have a little bit more success. I mean, heck, in the first half, not only were they goose egg, they were outgained by Julian Edelman in receiving yards.
But I was surprised that Sean McVay came into the game saying, we are going to try and do exactly what we have always done, because he was up against Bill Belichick. Like, I thought he was going to throw a curveball out early or maybe come a little bit aggressive and go in a different direction and then settle back into the 11 personnel stuff. I get that he did the two tight end stuff in the second half, but it was a little surprising that he just said, we're going to be us in the first half, right?
Well, you got to be you. That's what you got you there. I mean, you can't all of a sudden start changing up your game plan. I mean, let's be honest, they don't have 21 personnel.
Right.
Something that New England runs a lot with James Devlin. They really don't have the ability then to go in 22 personnel. They're two tight ends, two running backs, one wide receiver, right?
Yeah.
So they're limited in what they can do based on their roster and based on what they have. So you're not going to go into the game and say, hey, it's Bill Belichick. Is there a fullback out there we can add to the team? or we've got to change up what we're going to do. I think they're going to try to run what they think is going to be effective versus the New England Patriots. And to be quite honest, in the beginning of the game, you're just trying to figure out what the New England Patriots is going to do and how you can settle in and make those adjustments. So that's the difficulty for any team going against New England is, they've got their 10 to 15 plays that are starters and they're running them and they're saying, okay, this is how they're playing this personnel grouping in this formation. This is how they play this formation. This is what they do when we motion, or this is what they do when we shift. And the difficulty is the next time you come back out, you think you're going to get that same coverage, that same front. And it's different, or it might be a different personnel group that they put in on defense. Last time they played nickel, this time they're playing dime. So all those things, are just Bill Belichick's genius of staying ahead. And we used to call that when we play, he's a Rolodex coordinator, meaning you're not going to get the same thing again. He's going to keep rotating through every single time to give you different looks. So in third and six plus, and really that was one of the biggest differences in the game. I think at one point, Jared Goff was like 0 for 7 or 0 for 8. On third down with a sack, and they could not stay on the field. They couldn't move the sticks, and a lot of it had to do with the variations in coverage that they were showing them all the time. Whether it was three with the strong safety rotating down, three weak with the weak safety rotating down, a version of quarters, they played a little bit, literally about everything that you could. They played doubled coverage at time, which some people call cover seven, when they looked to double a couple different guys. And so it kind of, to some guys, looks like man, but in other ways they're thinking, all right, is it man or is it more of a match zone? They do as good of a job of anyone at disguising the way in which they're playing coverage, and putting more pressure on the quarterback. So, it wasn't that so much that Sean McVay was necessarily fooled. I just think it was Bill Belichick always being one step ahead. And again, it helps when your guys win the battle at the line of scrimmage.
Yep.
I mean, go across the entire Rams offensive line. They did not play well. When they did go 12 personnel, they did start to have more success in the second half. Another thing I saw was in 11 personnel, they put Everett in more at tight end instead of Higbee, and they started to have a little bit more success too with that matchup. Everett with a little more speed than Higbee playing the tight end position.
Now, did you end up? We don't need to get into why you were watching it. Did you end up watching? Where did you end up watching the game? Because I offered my seat to you. You saw my seat where I was sitting. And you said, no thanks. And then you pointed at somebody in the press box. You said, hey, Tommy, give me a suite. And then you just disappeared into some place with like grapes and cheese, right?
Right. I was like, hey, Tommy boy, get over here. No, so obviously there's some benefits to having multiple employers. And one thing I really, really appreciate about SiriusXM is just how organized they are. How my guys like Steve Cohen and Nick Pavlatos have all their stuff together. So I knew if what I thought was going to happen at the Super Bowl was indeed going to happen, that I could talk to my guys at SiriusXM NFL Radio and they could help me out. So Bob Papa, who's a good friend, he does a tremendous job on play-by-play. Him and Charles Davis, who's as smooth of a listen as you'll get, they were doing the world broadcast. So I got to kind of sit in their booth and basically not only listen to their call, but also watch the game from their booth.
That's a good spot to be in, and I would assume that that's a pretty good view, and you can kind of see the defenses unfolding and all that. Of course, you're a former quarterback, so that probably helps too. And a knowledgeable NFL, yeah. Okay, you call a lot of games, see a lot of football. Have you watched the game again since the?
I haven't had a chance to watch it again. Was obviously busy traveling. No.
I didn't think you would have had time. I just didn't know if it was like you got up and like did 100 push-ups and then watched a football game again or something like that.
No.
Like me, that's what I did.
Dude, where's my car?
Right.
I was literally wandering Atlanta this morning at 5 a.m. because the valet somehow moved or misplaced my rental car. So I was dealing with that for a good portion of the morning. And then just trying to figure out if I could make it to my flight on time, which didn't happen.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you heard. The security at Atlanta was maybe the longest line people have ever seen. So that just basically added up to my whole entire day. I missed radio. I missed everything. So the whole entire day kind of got thrown off.
You did miss
I did intend on watching it today, though.
No. I wasn't criticizing you for not watching it, just so we're clear. But you did end up recording a podcast, even though you did all that travel. That's true dedication to this Pick Six podcast.
That's true.
Crap, I had a question I was going to ask you, but instead, we're going to take a very quick break.
The hit Paramount Plus original docuseries returns.
The last time I saw Max, he looked at us laughing, and then everything changed in a blink of an eye.
My feeling as a detective is that he was murdered.
Yahoo Entertainment calls it a spine-chilling docuseries showcasing real-life tragedies.
What about when your child who went missing?
We need to know the truth.
Never seen again. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
The baseball season is in full swing, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Stample, every weekday as we recap every player from every game. We'll talk waiver wire ads, drops, players to trade for, prospects who could make an impact, and everything in between. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.
All right, so we mentioned the Rams, personnel, and all that stuff. Does the outcome of this game ding your perception at all of Sean McVay or Jared Goff?
Of Jared Goff, yeah. Because wow. The common denominator over the course of his time with the Rams is when he's had good protection, he's been good. When he hasn't, he's been really bad. And that's the only thing you can really say when you go back and kind of look through the course of his career. His rookie year didn't have protection at all. It was bad. The times in which he struggled last year, same thing. I mean, look, he's got a lot of things at his disposal. He's got a good offensive line. He's got Todd Gurley in the backfield, which that's a whole nother conversation. And he's got a bright offensive mind and a bunch of different guys to throw to. So you can't fall into a better situation as a quarterback. And for him not to be able to just make more plays, it's a bit surprising. Like, I know it sounds critical, but look, the Rams are in a position where he's going into his fourth year next year. And they've got to decide if they're going to pick up his fifth-year option.
Yep.
And, like, this one could drag out a little bit. People might say I'm nuts in saying that. I just think enough people around the league look at Sean McVay, and they look at that roster, they look at that team, and they're like, maybe a lot of other guys could put up those sorts of numbers and do that sort of thing if they were in his position too.
Well, and let's not forget that the Rams – predicated this whole all-in situation with 2018 by having a quarterback on his rookie deal. Jared Goff was a first overall pick, so it's still an expensive deal, but relative to, you know, a massive second contract, it's not insane. And they were able to, you know, sign Brandon Cook, sign Todd Gurley, sign Aaron Donald, trade for Keith Tlaib, trade for Marcus Peters, trade for Cooks, who they later signed. They did all these things. I don't know that you necessarily have the freedom with as big a contract, even though the salary cap is high. Is there any chance that they would consider trading Jared Goff and drafting a different quarterback?
I don't know. I mean, that would be a big one to me. I don't know. Do you want to go that route? You've invested a lot of time in him. So I think you might want to give it another year, you know, before you look at how you're going to handle everything. I mean, look, I think they'll pick up his fifth year option. I think it's too big of a risk not to just say, yeah, we're going to push and try to let him go into free agency. You know, because what happens if they do find themselves in the Super Bowl next year and then they win it and he plays great,
right?
Now you look like a clown show. So they're going to pick up the option. It's just, you know, it's a big year for him. I think ultimately in regards to what the Rams could potentially offer him as far as a long-term contract, looking at that second deal based on how he played in this game. So, yeah, I think I came away with the impression of this. From all the assistants that came from New England that I played for as a player, they did as good job at simplifying what a guy's good at, what he's not at. And I can guarantee you from watching Jared Goff and film, and I said this on the set, if you get pressure on him, he's a different quarterback. He's a different player. You can make that case for a lot of guys.
Sure.
But there, certain players' play doesn't diminish quite as much as Jared Goff's does. And that's what I saw in film. Pete and I talked about it during the week a lot. That, look, Jared Goff's floor is a lot lower than Tom Brady's is going to be in that game. And I would say Tom Brady's floor is a lot closer to Jared Goff's ceiling. And so because of that, you know, you just didn't know what you're going to get. And I think early on, he seemed a bit shook. You know, and that's expected, but he just can never really get any composure throughout the course of the game. And that's ultimately what hurt him.
Yeah, I mean, look, they got a ton of pressure on him. You saw it from the get-go. And for whatever reason, the referees were not inclined to sling around flags. I know there's some questionable, you know, Nicole Roby Coleman had that like 2-week-old makeup call that was thrown on him. And the Rams ultimately ended up with 9 penalties for 65 yards. Patriots only 3 for 20, but it didn't feel like with either quarterback that the refs were interested in protecting those quarterbacks that if you wanted to get push the line on getting a shot on Tom Brady or Jared Goff, you could do it. And both guys really got banged up pretty bad. And I think Brady, for as much as there is a huge age difference, you know, he's dealt with this so much more and on this stage so much more that it was probably easier to overcome. But let's be honest, Tom Brady wasn't good either.
No, I would say this is probably one of his more underwhelming performances. There was times where he seemed frazzled. I mean, look, the first interception was shocking to me.
Yeah, it was terrible.
I mean, not only was he late getting his body over to address that throw if you wanted to make it, but it was just a poor ball. You know, he's as good as anyone at putting a football in a spot where his wide receiver gets it or no one does. And that was an instance where I was like, first off, it's Chris Hogan. I mean, and again, no disrespect to Chris Hogan, but, you know, that's not a guy I'm trying to force a ball into. Gronk, Edelman, I get it. Anyone else doesn't make as much sense. So that was surprising. And then just, you know, really a couple of the throws he made where he was kind of pulling them into the ground, throwing them low. I mean, I guess better be safe than sorry, but there was one screen in particular that James White, and there was pressure from the Rams. They had a seam, and he just yanked it at his feet. And there's really no other explanation. I mean, I got the sense that maybe he felt like they sniffed it out, but I think if he gets that ball to White, that could have been a huge play. And really, that series in particular I'm talking about, they stopped the clock on a number of those incompletions and gave the Rams the ball back and could have eaten up the clock back when they had that lead. So it wasn't his best game. However, it didn't need to be because of how good the defense played. And let's be honest, the final drive, the way Josh McDaniels settled in, they basically sat in 21 personnel. They ran the football until they got in plus territory, and then they basically spread them out and went empty. And what that does is, much like I talked about the Rams being predictable with their 11 personnel and allowing the New England Patriots defense to pattern match, the New England Patriots being in 21 personnel and putting Devlin all the way on the outside, that gave them a man zone indicator. So if it's man, you're looking at which guy do I think is going to win at that matchup. If it's zone, now you're really looking at the inside. And you're saying, where's Edelman? Where's Gronk? Who are they matched up against on the inside since you got your cornerbacks on the outside and your safeties and linebackers on the inside? And you saw a completion to Edelman who got yards after the catch for a big gain. You then saw a completion to Burkhead. And these are all basically the same concepts, all out of their empty formation. And then finally, the big completion to Gronk. Again, same play. They just changed the formation a little bit. But it was pretty phenomenal to look at the job that, again, the Patriots did making adjustments, and then Tom Brady just making clutch throws in that drive to go put them in a position to score a touchdown.
Yeah, really. I actually, as you were saying that, I just happened to see a Next Gen Stats tweet pop up on my timeline, and it's like, how did the Patriots offense break tendency on their TD drive? They used two running backs on all five plays, shifting into empty and running the same play three consecutive times, and Tom Brady on those plays against the Rams base defense, 4 of 4 for 67 yards. That to me, maybe like that, as well as, you know, what Belichick was doing and that the way the defensive line got pressure, it just, the Patriots knew they're in this grind, like in this meat grinder game, and they understood, all right, like, our defense can stop these guys, and we just need to get, it just reminds me of the 2001 season and the 2002 Super Bowl so much. It's like, hey, look, we gotta just keep going punch for punch with these guys on defense, and then we're gonna hand the ball to Tom and let Josh cook something up. Obviously, Josh went there in 2001 as the OC, but, you know, let Tom lead a big drive for a touchdown. It was just quintessential Patriots like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I had Charlie Weiss when he was there. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. The league is going in more of a three wide receiver set spread formation, right? So what do the New England Patriots do? When everyone's going one way, they go to the other. Yeah. And so they play more 12. They play more 21, more base personnel. They play more 22 personnel. With those two tight ends, two running back sets. So they seem to do things differently than everyone else is doing them. And I think it's tough for defenses to stop because they very rarely see that from their opponents. And then they very rarely see it from their own team. I mean, think about in practice in the offseason where you're going up against your ones. If you're Sean McVay, you're mostly running 11 personnel. You know, your defense isn't going to be as prepared for when they see two tight ends, two running backs, right? And you're playing smash mouth football. Same thing in their base personnel. Or when they split out, you know, with your base personnel, if you don't have a fullback, right, your linebackers and safeties aren't prepared for the ISO blocks, the back-on-backer blocks, or the bob plays like we talk about. So there's all those additional things that you obviously don't get a lot of practice at, and you don't see a whole lot, either A, if your opponents don't do it since the league's not moving in that direction, or B, you don't have it on your roster. So there's no way to mimic that or get a true sense of how it's actually going to work out. I think those are things that always kind of go unnoticed sometimes, these matchups.
Yeah, it's sort of like when like if a team has to play Georgia Tech or you know, when they had Paul Johnson running the option, or like or Army, Navy, whoever it is, on, you know, on, you don't have a bye before, you haven't played an option team yet that year. I mean, it's just hard to prepare for something you don't see very often, and that was certainly the case. Do you think the Patriots should pay Rob Gronkowski what he is owed on the final year of his contract, or should they save $8 million and cut him loose? Or it's also possible. It's also possible he could retire.
I would not cut him. Ooh. I would not cut him. I mean, look, he might retire anyway. That's something he talked about and discussed. And the bottom line is, you know, 2 weeks from now, his body's going to feel better than it does now.
Sure.
Right? He was limping around a little bit after the game. You know, Pete and I saw him on the field. It looked like he had a thigh contusion from a hit he took early in the game. But up until that point, he was moving around well. So, I mean, typically you take a few days to decompress. All of a sudden your body starts feeling better. You know, even a month from now, you start being like, man, I kind of miss my buddies. I miss football. I want that feeling again. Because I can tell you this much. I never played in the Super Bowl. But being able to be down there in the field, to sit back, take it all in, knowing some of those guys, you know, talking to a guy like Kevin Youkilis, for example, who won a World Series with the Boston Red Sox, who was down there with Tom Brady's family, and just, you know, sitting back and talking to him about his championship or championships, and talking to, you know, other players down there and coaches on their staff about it. I mean, it's something that it drives you to want to do it all over again. Now, it's a grind, and especially in New England, but at the end of the day, man, once he starts feeling better, I think he's going to come back for an additional year. Because I don't know why you'd want to try to miss out on an opportunity to be with Tom Brady and try to do this again as long as he's still playing.
Yeah, and look, the reality is the Patriots are going to have a chance to do it because while Josh Allen might be great, Sam Darnold might be great, I don't think we're there yet with either of the Bills or the Jets. The Dolphins look like they are in full-blown rebuild mode, and you know, they just took a guy that Bill Belichick has intimate knowledge of, and Brian Flores. Great defensive game plan by him too. You know, calling those whether he's calling the plays or helping design it with Bill Belichick, whatever it is, he did a great job. I mean, you got a shot for seven. right? To top Michael Jordan. Like, that's how far Tom Brady has gone. he's no longer worried about being the greatest football player of all time. He's now worried about trying to top, you know, to become the greatest athlete of all time. And I think he's got a viable case given the sport and all the things that are around him. And you see that video that he and Gronk post on Instagram, and I know it's, you know, right after the game, and they're winning and they're happy and all that, but it's not hard to imagine Gronk being back next year and Brady saying, look, dude, let's go for one more ride, and say, hey, Bill, I know you can save something on the salary cap, but we'll just put this guy in the garage until the playoffs and then cut him loose, and we win three games with Gronk and we win the Super Bowl. I mean, it's not that complicated, right?
No, it's not. But I think the thing about Bill Belichick is he's never made exceptions for players on his roster.
Right.
And that was probably the scuttlebutt that those two got into in the past, where he doesn't want to treat Tom Brady different than any other guy on the team. In fact, he probably wants to be as hard on him as anyone else.
Sure.
And because if you can do that to the quarterback, if you can do that to Tom Brady, then you better believe everyone else is going to fall in line. So when you start making exceptions for guys like Gronk, guys like Tom Brady, It changes how guys respond in the locker room, because everyone looks at each other as equals. I mean, especially, you know, again, even though it is Tom Brady, when he's going out there every day in practice, when he's going out there and you know, doing everything he can and working his tail off, everyone else is motivated by it, right? I mean, it's inspirational at this point, because what else does he have to prove? Nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, in my opinion, he's already, what he's accomplished is already better than what Michael Jordan did, in my opinion. I mean, you could talk about the six titles, but it's also about the fact that he's made it to however many Super Bowls. And he's done it over a period of time in which it's hard to be able to talk about who could even come close to that. So, again, for me, different story. He is the greatest of all time. He has nothing else to prove. But it would just be another feather in his cap, where there really wouldn't be any argument. Like, much like I said, this past Super Bowl, for all those people who would say, well, he's arguably the greatest of all time. No. There is no argument now. It's just Tom Brady, the greatest of all time, the GOAT. The people who wanted to try to make that argument, they're saying uncle. They don't want it anymore. Like, they're hoping he doesn't go to another Super Bowl and win seven. That's the point we're getting to. It's just painful for them to watch.
Yeah, like, Joe Montana is incredible. Even Joe Montana should be willing to admit now that Tom Brady was already the GOAT anyway, but, I mean, like, now it's like, it's not even close. Also, this is a little bit more debatable, or maybe less debatable, depending on how you feel about it. Is Julian Edelman a potential Hall of Famer? I think, I don't know if we talked about this before the Super Bowl. I know we probably talked about it leading up to the Super Bowl. I am of the opinion that it would be insane to put someone in the Hall of Fame based solely on postseason success and statistics. Julian Edelman's really impressive in what he's done in the postseason, but his regular season numbers are certainly not Hall of Fame. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, the weird thing is we're having this conversation. It's like, is he done? Like, I didn't think he was talking about retiring. So that's kind of like the weird thing. And I think another guy you might want to throw into that category that just got into the Hall of Fame was Ty Law. I mean, look, Ty Law played for a long time. But if you just looked at his stats and you said, all right, he was a two-time All-Pro, no three-time Super Bowl champ. I think it was the MVP, too, in one of those Super Bowls, if I'm not mistaken. You know, he's probably not going to make it in as a two-time All-Pro. I know he's a five-time Pro Bowler, but that's kind of how I feel. Like, and again, no disrespect to Ty Law. It's just the bottom line is when you look at, you know, his career, he had a couple really, really good seasons where he had just a ridiculous amount of interceptions, like early in his career and then kind of late. But outside of that, there were just kind of more average years. So he was a guy to me that, when I saw that he got in, I was like, okay, kind of interesting. But I do think his postseason success had a lot to do with people being like, well, you know what, though? He played really, really clutch in the postseason to help, you know, that team win some Super Bowls, like legitimately played an impact. I mean, Julian Edelman's starting to build a case for that. And I think the more he continues to play and then adds on to his stats and adds on to his career, I think he's definitely going to have a case.
So he would need, let's see, I think he averages like 7 catches per postseason game. And he would need like six more games in the playoffs. So if he can get 2 more years out of Tom Brady, 2 more Super Bowl runs, or even 3 years and, you know, maybe 2 conference championship runs, which is not implausible, I don't think, he could break Jerry Rice's record for receptions in the playoffs. And that would, that would go a pretty long way towards, I feel like if that happened, people might not be willing to keep him out, right?
Yeah, I think it'd be tough. But again, you're talking about that's what, two or three more seasons, depending on how many games. Yeah. Let's say two, if we're saying the Patriots and they're going to Super Bowl. So now that's very likely. So let's say they go to two more and that is the case. I mean, not only is it, you know, those receptions you're talking about, but it's also looking at their success. Like, does he have another Super Bowl? Maybe he wins another MVP. I mean, I just think you continue to keep building on more and more a case. And so numbers are one thing, but you'd be hard pressed to find a guy that doesn't demand more respect from defenses and defensive backs than Julian Edelman, you know, and just with the way he plays, the position that they put him in.
Yeah. And I mean, what he did in the Super Bowl was pretty friggin' incredible in terms of route running and moving all over the place. And just, I mean, like Wade Phillips put Aqib Talib on him and that was a horrible mismatch. At one point, you know, they had a linebacker on Edelman. That's not going to work out. Even if it's a fast linebacker like Corey Littleton, you know, it's just he's a great receiver. Who would be, if you had to pick somebody right now to win the Super Bowl, or what do you think about Kansas City being the favorite to win the Super Bowl, next season?
What an overreaction to the way that game went. You know, it's interesting how that all worked out because I look at the way that went and I think to myself, this is a great defensive game. You know, both offenses had their moments, but they really struggled and that's okay. And I think everyone's looking at the Chiefs saying that's an offense that didn't struggle this year, really in any game. And if they win the coin toss, they're probably representing the AFC, not the New England Patriots, but they didn't win the coin toss. It was New England and the rest is history. I think that's probably the general consensus of that team. And I also think people are looking at Steve Spagnuolo coming in and them being able to, you know, make some adjustments on defense and saying that they think that they'll be able to find a way to win. I think the difference is they might not have home field advantage, right? Like if I was betting on a division to be better next year, the AFC East or the AFC West, I think the AFC West is probably going to be more competitive. So, for that reason, I kind of feel like it's hard to pick against the New England Patriots only because of their history and the track record, unless something drastically changes.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, the Patriots are really good. Somebody will rise up and make a stink there. Maybe it'll be the Saints or the Chiefs. I mean, there's still plenty of teams out there who will have problems. If I were betting on it, I was looking at it. I mean, I think the Colts have some pretty good odds. I don't know that the Colts are going to magically win the Super Bowl all of a sudden, but I think they can make improvements this offseason. And so, I'm looking for somebody like 20-1. I don't want to be sub 10-1 if I'm making those bets. Anything surprise you about this season when you look back on what happened in 2018?
I think it was, you know, looking back now, hilarious the way the hype around the Oakland Raiders and John Gruden and just that whole deal and then the way it went. I mean, people thinking that like John Gruden was going to take them back to the promised land and just the trading away Cleo Mack and trading away Amari Cooper. I mean, I just, the whole thing blew my mind. How he handled it, how the team was run, firing Reggie McKenzie. Now it looks like they're going to be playing in the San Francisco 49ers stadium, Giants stadium in 2019 before they head to Vegas. I don't know. That's an organization that I'm excited for them to get to Las Vegas so they can get settled down and settled in and actually be a good football team because they weren't this year, but it also seemed like that was by design.
Yeah, we'll see if they're good next year. I don't think that's necessarily going to happen. That didn't surprise me because I had the Raiders being terrible. I'm trying to think, is there somebody that really shocked me about this year? I had a pretty good read on, like, and this isn't always, I mean, this is just a random year where I actually had a good read on it. So nothing really stunned me about this season. I'm trying to think if there's somebody I just completely whiffed on. I don't think I whiffed on anybody. Maybe I just had a perfect season.
Well,
maybe.
I didn't necessarily whiff on anyone. I was shocked by the Minnesota Vikings. Not making the playoffs.
Yeah. The Packers stinking. Packers and Vikings.
Yeah.
I had that division wrong. And then actually I completely whiffed on the Cowboys. I had the Cowboys way wrong. So that surprised me that the Cowboys were good. Although now they're not going to give Jason Garrett an extension. What's up with that?
You know, he had done this before though. And he coached for his job. He went 12-4 that year. So I'm not I'm not necessarily against it. I mean, bottom line is I think Jason Garrett and Jerry Jones have a close enough relationship where, you know, he ain't trying to go anywhere. I mean, honestly, like where are you trying to take that? You're going to try to go be head coach somewhere else than the most expensive franchise in the NFL. I think Jerry has all the leverage there in that case. He knows it. And he wants Jason Garrett to understand the message. Like, it's put up or shut up time. Either you get us into the playoffs and get us, you know, get us going a little bit more than just one win. And or otherwise, you know, it's a time to move on. So it's going to be a big year for them. And I'll be curious to see what additions or subtractions they make. But, you know, the whole thing with him not getting an extension isn't surprising.
No, I mean, but it is weird how there was all, it was like the buzz was like, Jared Garrett's going to get an extension. He's going to get paid. Jerry loves him. They won the division. And then all of a sudden you lose that playoff game to the Rams. And it's like, maybe we'll just see how this whole contract plays out. Are you excited about your debut? Are you broadcasting the AAFL or the AFL?
No. What? Someone else asked me, I'm like, why did people think I would be broadcasting the AAFL?
Because you know, it's on CBS Sports. You work for CBS Sports. Maybe they thought
I work for their digital platform. I call games. I have, Fox has exclusive rights to me. As far as televised games, in
why
that
did
regard.
So why did
not,
why did why didn't
yeah,
we
I'm not able
why,
to
why didn't we buy you out? Why didn't we buy your we should purchase your soul and use it? It's stuffed into the AFL.
That's a whole other conversation. So I'm not. I really don't know what to say to that.
Well,
so,
I'll say something. We should buy every bit of Brady Quinn stock, pay whatever it costs. That's what I say. And then you in turn. Say, give Will Brinson a giant raise. That's what you say.
Okay. Well, yeah. I think with the way you were able to somehow, some way, get us some seats in the press box, which seemed bleak in the final hour, you deserve a lot of credit for that, my friend.
Thank you. Not enough
that people can appreciate what you did. It was kind of like Fire Festival, I think, the Netflix documentary.
I'll
leave it at that. There was a lot of sacrifices being made.
I had to get that. That water was getting across the border, pal. I don't know how, but it was good.
Yeah.
You know, we got done covering the Super Bowl. We get down to the Moxie, which is our hotel bar, and Prisco's down there, and Jamie Eisenberg looks at our colleague Jamie, looks at Eric Kay, our boss. He's like, Brinson picked, you know, saved it. And Pete's like, did he really? Prisco's like, I don't know. I mean, like, I could have done that. It's not that big a deal. It's like, all right, there you go, Pete. There you go.
No. There is no doubt in my mind Pete Prisco would have done exactly, probably more than what you did in order to make it happen. Yeah.
Right. Pete would have managed to text and phone call with 17 different people at once, coordinate with the RFID, NFL people, coordinate with NFL PR, coordinate with CBS PR, and do all of that in the span of 2 hours in order to secure us, press box credentials. I'm sure that seems like something Pete would totally do. I will give Pete credit though. He probably talked for at least like 3 or 4 hours all week long on HQ, right? I mean, we did pretty good work in Fort Lauderdale.
Well, that's kind of his thing though. He just doesn't stop talking.
Yeah. He's like, I can't believe they're making me get up there and talk. It's like, you just talk. That's what you do. All right. We'll get out of here on this. What did you think about the, official hirings? We knew they were happening. But we got to worry about the Josh McDaniels style situation. What did you think about Zach Taylor to the Bengals? They announced it on Monday after the Super Bowl when the Rams lost, and Brian Flores to the Dolphins announced after the Patriots won.
First time head coaches for both sides. I always preach patience. I'm excited to see what Brian Flores is going to bring to Miami. But here's the thing that I know. I think Chris Greer is within the front office now. He's really the head guy. He wants to create that New England model in Miami. Really hard to do.
Yeah.
Okay? Like, really hard to do. For starters, you don't have Tom Brady. Already report they're going to cut Ryan Tannehill. So good luck finding the next Tom Brady. The next thing is it's hard to mimic their culture because – You have guys like Chris Greer who, you know, one, maybe they're as good as Bill Belichick at identifying talent, maybe not. Either way, you end up finding yourself in positions where you make bad personnel decisions. Either you don't value certain things like characteristic and understand how you can put certain guys in position to make plays, or, you know, you pay a guy and you don't realize how it's going to change a guy. So there's a lot of different reasons why no one can mimic what Bill Belichick has been able to do. Those are just a couple. But I think that's what they're looking to do with Brian Flores. And they're looking to improve their defense in order to help out whatever kind of offense that they have.
Yeah, and I would add, too, that I think that this sort of goes under the radar a little bit because of their consistency and because of the quarterback and because of the coach. Robert Kraft is a really good owner, and the Krafts do a really good job of staying out of the way and letting the football guys do football things and giving them unlimited resources. And look, it's easy to do when you're on this roll and you have Belichick and Brady. But you know, I mean, like Kraft, I mean, ownership matters in professional football in a big way.
It's huge. Like that's the first thing I noticed when I got traded from Cleveland to Denver. It's no disrespect to Cleveland, but Pat Bowlen was a fantastic owner. The expectation of that organization, given its rich history, you could sense all the way down to the equipment guys or the trainer Greek who's been there forever. It's like every single person there, you could just sense that sort of excellence, everything that they stood for, and it comes top down. And it was the same way when I got to Seattle. It was kind of, you know, it was hit and miss with how things were in St. Louis because you could feel like Stan Kroenke, you knew he was eventually going to try to move on. New York was a whole different story with the Jets. And then Kansas City was kind of interesting. Like that was kind of a team. And really the ownership structure at that point was different than what it is now. I think they had some things sorted out with some of the family matters they had going on. But you can tell. That's one of the biggest things. We're going from organization to organization. You can tell, and it really matters. So Stephen Ross just needs to stay out of the kitchen, let those guys handle their business. And then Zach Taylor going to a place where, look, they need an innovative offense. They need to get the most they can out of the talented players that they have. Hopefully he can bring some of that from L.A. to the Cincinnati Bengals. And then the one thing I think they've got to their advantage is, you know, they can, again, preaching patience because they were patient with Marvin Lewis. And this is an organization that I don't think, you know, wants to move on to another guy anytime soon and pay out additional years of contracts and money. So he's got that working for him. But that's a really big uphill battle, in my opinion, because I think that division – is really good out around the Cincinnati Bengals right now.
Yeah, it's a tough spot. Like you always had those two games against the Browns, and now those two games against the Browns are a bit of a nightmare, but at least you don't have Baker Mayfield gunning for Hugh Jackson. And at least the Bengals didn't hire Hugh Jackson. I give him an A++++++ for hiring anybody other than him. I give you an A++++++ for your work at the Super Bowl, Brady. You broke a record, you now hold a Guinness Book of World Record.
I didn't break the record. It's Jarvis Landry's record. I was just there along for the ride, helping him achieve it.
That's how you become the greatest football player in Notre Dame history, is with that humility.
I'm just telling you right now, I don't get a plaque. My name's not on anything. It's purely about the one-handed catches.
In better news, at least you and your wife didn't lose in horseshoes to two NFL blockers. That didn't happen. So you're fine. That never happened. At least
you even consider yourself a writer. You consider yourself a blogger. Is that where we're stooping to right now?
No, I'm a secret.
Hey, I carried my own weight. Okay. I think you witnessed that. Yeah. There was another member of my team that unfortunately we were losing a fair amount to. I won't name names, but my wife did almost kill me. So.
It was a fun time. And thank you for letting us, hang with your family. It was good times. And it's been a fun season. It's been an awesome podcast season. And we're not done. Yeah. We'll go through the off season.
No, we're going to keep it rolling.
Oh, yeah. We'll keep it rolling. And we'll be back tomorrow. So make sure to subscribe, rate, review. Thanks, Brady.
Anytime.